Greetings, I'm Fred Zaspel. Welcome to another author interview here at Books at a Glance. We're talking today to Dr. Steve Davis about his new book, The War of the Camisards, 1702 to 1704. If you've not heard of the Camisards before, you're in a lot of company. I'm with you. Steve, great to have you with us.
Hey, Fred, thank you. It's great to be with you again. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. I got to tell you, when I saw the book, I thought, "What in the world is a Camisard?" I like church history, I like Reformed church history, and I don't know what this is or anything about it. So, you got a lot to teach me here today.
Well, you're not alone. We were in France for many years, and I don't know that I ever heard the word Camisard while we were there. Knew very little. Sad to say, about French history and French religious history. I wish I would have known more. So this became new to me several years ago.
Okay, well, good. I feel a little bit better. Well, let's start off. Who were the Camisards, and what does the word Camisard mean?
Okay. All right, let me try to just put it in, a historical perspective.
Yeah.
Basically, the Camisards were, we might call them peasant warriors who led a revolt against King Louis XIV, the great Sun King, in the early 1700s. Now, to put that in perspective, we're looking now at almost 200 years after the beginning of the Reformation in France. And the Reformation made great inroads, first through the teaching of Luther, but then mostly through Calvin's teaching. And in the 1500s, you had a series of eight wars of religion, where the Reformed Protestants, were called Huguenots, were able to hold their own against the royal troops of the different kings at that time. And so they were led by nobles, a lot of nobility involved in those wars. And then with the conversion of Henry of Navarre, who was a Huguenot, he became a Catholic and became King Henry IV. And in 1598, he promulgated the Edict of Nantes, because he was still sympathetic to his former co-religionaries. And the Protestants at that time then obtained some limited religious freedom. Well, Henry IV was assassinated in 1610. I'm just giving you a quick interview to get you to the Camisard. 1610, Henry XIV is assassinated. His son, Louis XIII, becomes king, begins to undermine the Edict of Nantes, just eating away little by little the rights of Protestants. Then Henry IV's grandson, Louis XIV, became king around 1643, and he continued that that process, undermining the rights, persecution, just began to increase. Finally, in 1685, Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes, called the Revocation of the Edict of Nantes, one historian called it one of the greatest crimes in history. So in 1685, there was the myth that Protestantism no longer, Protestants had mostly converted to Catholicism under coercion, and so that there was no longer any need for the Edict of Nantes. So it was revoked. Protestantism was outlawed in 1685. All the pastors left, and this is important for what happened later. Pastors were given 15 days to either go into exile or convert to Catholicism. Many converted and many left. So the Protestants were left without pastors. Their churches, called temples, were destroyed. So they had no place to worship. They began worshiping in clandestine assemblies and out of the way places, and that was called the Church of the Desert. But there was persecution, there was executions. Preachers that were caught were executed, or they were put on the king's galley ships as rowers for life. So From 1685 until the war began in 1702, you have 17 years of a simmering rebellion. And the Protestants are oppressed, they're imprisoned, their children are forced to go to Catholic school. They have to be baptized in the Catholic Church as infants. Marriage is only done by the Catholic Church. Any other marriage is illegitimate. Children were kidnapped, put into convents. King Louis XIV practiced what are called dragonnades, which was putting royal troops into the homes of Protestants to force them to convert. So they had to house troops in their homes, pay for their upkeep and everything, and all the abuse that went along with that. So 1702 is when the war actually began, and there was a trigger. There was the murder of a or assassination, they called it, of a Catholic abbot. But during that simmering time, there's no pastors, there's no churches. They're meeting in secret. They're meeting in their homes, but they really don't have spiritual guidance. All their pastors are in exile, what was called the refuge. And there was a wave of what's called prophetism, where self-appointed prophets and prophetesses arose. And many of them began in preaching what we would call an evangelical message. They're preaching repentance. They're preaching turning to God. And after a time, that kind of evolved into a message of violence, nourished by the Old Testament and the wars of Israel. And so you have the Church of the Desert, which is meeting in secret, reminiscent of the wanderings of the children of Israel in the wilderness. You have the prophets and prophetesses who are stoking rebellion. And you have an abbot, Duchyla, who is arresting Protestants. And in his home, he has a prison. He has jail cells where he interrogates Protestants. They're tortured. And a group of Protestants led by prophets who had received inspiration, claimed inspiration from the Holy Spirit, went to free their fellow Protestants. And that triggered the war. They killed the abbot, they burned it down, they freed the prisoners, and the war began at that time. Now they're called Camisards. There's a couple explanations. One comes from a man by the name of Abraham Mazel, who was called the last of the Camisards, who was executed in 1710. He said it comes from the shirt that they wore. It was kind of a peasant smock, you might say, that showed that they were, most of the Camisards were rural people, many of them illiterate. They were farmers, they were bakers, they were sheep shearers, wool combers. So they were very simple, rustic people. And they wore these distinctive white shirts. There's another explanation that it might come from an old word for pathway, the paths that they followed through the mountains when they were ambushing the royal troops. But it may be the shirt that they wore, and that name just kind of stuck with them.
Did the Camisards expect to overthrow the French government entirely? Or what was their end goal, and how did it end?
Well, I don't know that they didn't have any expectation of human victory. But their hope was always that God would intervene. And we actually see this, that God would intervene and change the king's heart. I mean, that was really what they wanted to see happen. And it might seem odd, but you know, Protestants, even at this time, still professed loyalty to the king. I mean, they still had that idea of submission to the king, to the divine right of kings. And for a while, they didn't believe that Louis XIV was directly coordinating the repression. You know, they thought it was the governors and appointed officials. So they proclaimed their loyalty to the king. But there came a point where, after 17 years of intense persecution, the persecution had been going on before the revocation in 1685, the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. But after 17 years of that simmering tension there, again, the children are forced to go to Catholic school. People are forced. I mean, they're actually taken by royal troops to attend mass. If they didn't go to mass, they were fined. You had preachers of the clandestine assemblies that were executed. So many of these commissars, keep in mind now, they're most of them are in their 20s. They've never known a pastor, a real pastor. They had, because they all went into exile or converted Catholicism. They never had been in a church. They'd worshiped secretly, they'd worshiped at home, they'd seen people executed. The prophets and prophetesses, many of them were executed. And so it's been said by one historian that when the state persecuted the preachers, the prophets arose. And when they killed the prophets, the Camisards arose, filled with hate and vengeance. So it wasn't really about winning the war. It was, in many ways, protecting their families. And it was revenge. I mean, it was retaliation. But you get people who are pushed to that point for so long with such intense persecution. You know, the men are taking to row in the galley ships, which was a death sentence usually. You know, women were imprisoned for sometimes for decades. One of the most famous, Marie Durand, spent 38 years imprisoned in the Tower of Constance in southern France. So you have all of this going on, and retaliation, defense, I mean, vengeance, all very complex, but all of these things came together. What is amazing is that they held out for so long. I mean, the war ended in 1704. There were skirmishes and ambushes and things like that up to 1710 when Abraham Mazel, the last of the Camisards, was executed. But for 2 years, they held off the French royal troops. And a number of reasons why they were able to do that. They were greatly outnumbered. There were probably at any given time up to 20,000 royal troops. There was probably never more than 2,000 Camisards at any one time. But they didn't do open, you know, battles. Most of it
Was
was
it
ambushes.
guerrilla warfare?
It was great. I was going to say it was guerrilla warfare. The region, and again, it was localized. It was so different from the wars of religion of the 1500s, because then you had nobles, you had grand, you know, you had armies, you had, you know, battles going on. Well, now you have peasants dressed in their white smocks, many of them armed with pitchforks and any weapons they could gather, or you know, once they ambushed some of the king's troops, or they stole them from Catholics in villages who had been armed, and so they had a way of doing that. But it was guerrilla warfare, and the region where it was in southern France, called the Cevennes, is a very rugged, very mountainous region. And actually, the governor of that region began building roads, wider roads, in order to move, you know, troops and cannon and things like that to battle the Khamisars. So the Khamisars had that advantage. And Louis XIV was also engaged in other wars at that time. I mean, one thing about Louis XIV is that he was a warrior king. Not only did he, embellish and build Versailles, but there were always wars going on. One of the wars at that time was the War of Spanish Succession. So a lot of his troops and a lot of his best troops were occupied, either defending the borders or fighting against other countries, the alliances that were against the French at that time, Austria and Germany, Holland. So you didn't have the best troops. You had rugged terrain, and you had people of courage and conviction. I mean, tragically, there were also atrocities. The atrocities went both ways. I'm reminded of something that that Voltaire said. He said something like the hunted became the hunters.
Yeah, right.
They were like bears who cubs were bristled up. I mean, they
Yeah.
just turned viciously. And so they were, the Khamisars were also guilty of atrocities in their retaliation. The war came to an end in 1704. One of the main leaders of the Khamisars was a man by the name of John Cavalier, or Jean Cavalier, who was a baker, had gone to Geneva and become a baker and had been a shepherd. And he returned and became the kind of like the general of the Khamisars. And I got to tell you, I mean, these men were mostly in their 20s, and they became peasant warriors. I mean, when you read the accounts of some of the times they did confront the king's troops, they would regularly kneel down in prayer. I mean, hundreds of men, you can just picture them. They're kneeling down in prayer. They would sing. One of the psalms that became known as the hymn of the Khamisard was Psalm 68. Let God arise and his enemies be scattered. And these men were so feared that it would send shudders into the king's troops.
I love
So when you read
it.
about these men, I mean, one of the reasons I love studying them, certainly I can't excuse everything they did,
Right.
that they did in the name of God. But I do try to understand it as
Sure.
one of those horrible necessities of war. It was war. But the courage of these men, I remember one of the men right before the war, Claude Brousson, as he was led to his execution, a contemporary described, an eyewitness who was there said he looked like he was going to a feast. I mean, the confidence that when they died, I mean, there were times that they, before executing them, or by hanging or by burning at the stake or by drawing them and quartering them, they would cut their tongues out, so they wouldn't have to listen to them, because in their last moments, in their
Right.
dying moments, they're preaching or crying out to God. So with Jean Cavalier, he kind of became a legend. I mean, there's a lot of myths, there's legends, but he was courageous. He did lead. And there were a succession of French marshals that were sent by the king to try to put down the rebellion, and they all failed miserably. The last one that came, a man by the name of Villars, came and tried a different tactic of negotiation. He saw that the persecution, wasn't something that, they're not going to win. They're not going to win the hearts of people. And you had Catholic militias rising up and battling the Camisards, and And Catholics would burn and pillage and destroy Protestant villages. Protestants would do the same to Catholic villages. And again, innocent people were killed, women and children were slaughtered on both sides. So Villar negotiated with Cavalier, and there was a truce in 1704. Now, Cavalier didn't represent all of the Camisards. So some of them thought that he was a traitor and continued to fight. And
You said there were skirmishes up to 1710.
yeah, there were some skirmishes, but nothing serious.
Like that. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there were, so some take the war to 1710. Most ended at 1704,
Right.
because once Cavalier was gone, and then my book, I talk about a couple others that were executed shortly after that. But there were again, you're looking at a mountainous region, and you're looking at pockets of
Right.
rebellion. And at times it wasn't really, nothing much was going on.
Yeah.
So the king wasn't, king, he's fighting other wars. Louis XIV has other wars. So there was little reason to continue to pursue them. I mean, with Cavalier's negotiation surrender, and he left the country with a number of his men. He actually wound up in England and became a governor of the Isle of Jersey, I think it was.
How about that?
But most of the other leaders ended up executed. If they didn't surrender, if they were arrested, most of them were executed. And it was
Well,
a, go ahead.
now you've got these pastors in exile. How did they view the war and the Camisards themselves and the cause?
Most of them, again, they're writing and viewing this from a place of safety, which was a criticism. Many Protestants in France criticized the pastors in what was called the Refuge, because they weren't there with their people. They left, and they're in Holland, they're in Germany, they're in Switzerland. And many of them are critical of this revolt. They're still teaching and preaching submission to the king, submission to authorities. Of course, they weren't experiencing what these people are experiencing.
Right.
Now, there were exceptions. There was one man in particular, Pierre Jurieu, who was in Holland, who was kind of a prophet and writing apocalyptic, literature, and seeing in the book of Revelation, what was taking place, and trying to interpret that in light of contemporary events. So there was some support from the outside, from pastors in exile, but limited. But there was also some support from governments, who Protestant governments, who made promises of help. And even, there were a couple attempts to land troops, and they failed and never really got anywhere. And for the Protestant powers, it was more because of their opposition to Louis XIV and, the French kingdom. So there are political reasons there. And then the Camisards were accused of treason, being traitors, for resorting to using foreign powers as if the French king had never done that. I mean, that was common practice. So they, I think of Abraham Mazel, who executed in 1710. He had actually gone to Geneva and London after the war in exile. And, they were regarded, he was claimed to be a prophet. Whatever you say about him, he was a man of courage and conviction, perhaps misled in some ways, but he was still prophesying in London, and he was cast. I mean, they were rejected by Protestants in exile, because these were strange people. I mean, coming from, when Abraham Mazel went into exile, He had never been in a church. He had never known
Right.
a real ordained pastor. So when he gets
Right.
to Geneva and he sees this, it's just beyond anything he can comprehend. And he's critical of a lot of, their worship practices.
Well, I'm sure that went over well.
I mean, you have a guy who's a rugged John the Baptist type.
Yeah.
These people, I mean, they actually lived in the mountains for years, living off the land and, what they could get from people, whether through
Yeah.
raids or through friendly Protestants. I mean, these were rugged people, and the refinement of Geneva and the churches and London and so Abraham Mazel went back to France on his own. I mean, he was asked to do it, and it was to try to spark another insurrection. And he went back in 1709. He was arrested and executed in 1710. So even Protestants after that, the Protestantism has always looked at this very complex, because of what took place, especially the violence and the prophetism.
Yeah.
And then it came mostly from poor, illiterate, rustic peasants. And so it wasn't until, well, 5 years later in 1715, which is a whole nother area I'm investigating, hoping to work on a little bit more, is when what took place was called the Restoration of the Reformed Church with Antoine Court, who had lived through that time, had been associated with Camisards, and yet rejected, came to a point he rejected the prophetism, rejected violence, and began to rebuild the Reformed Church on on its original foundations. And that's another great, great history.
A couple of questions. How did the since the Camisards were defeated, did the war accomplish anything? And then what was the state of Protestantism after that? Was anything changed?
Well, I think what changed once there was the negotiation that took place in the truce in 1704, there was a little bit where the oppression was, we might say, relaxed. It wasn't so intense. Now, Protestantism was still illegal, but gradually there was more and more toleration. Now, that increased with the philosophers of the 1700s, with Voltaire and others, as they came. And although many of them despised religion completely, they did believe in that freedom of thought. So, little by little, these ideas of freedom of worship, freedom of conscience, which were antithetic to the French way of thinking, because you had the king, and under the king there was the dictum, one king, one law, one faith. And so, Louis XIV and other kings, they were seeking the unity, what they call the unity of the kingdom. But that unity of the kingdom had to be the unity of one faith.
Right.
So gradually that idea of tolerance began to gain hold. It really didn't take root until the French Revolution, 1789, when Protestantism, began to receive more rights than under Napoleon. After that, in the early 1800s, was actually recognized as a legitimate religion. So there was progress, and I think one of the things it also accomplished is it made the state reticent to persecute people to the extent that there's going to be another insurrection.
They didn't want that again.
Because the damage was only not only to France, and I mean, you had literally hundreds of villages that were burned to the ground. It was called the Devastation of the Cevennes. I have a chapter on that that describes how they went very methodically to destroy the homes of Protestants, tearing them down. And And yet, sometimes they had help even from Catholic priests who told them, take out anything of your house that can be burned, keep it from, any furnishings and things like that, because the houses are made of stone, so they're very difficult to burn completely. So it's like you might have something left when you come back, but they're completely destroyed. And so not only the damage in that sense, of course, they lost up to, France lost up to 200,000 people that went into exile. They weren't allowed to. I mean, Protestants, apart from pastors, were forbidden to leave the country. They were forbidden to emigrate. So you had this huge drain of artisans and other people, and it was often the peasants that couldn't escape. They didn't have the means to do that, or they weren't close enough to the borders to do that. But you had a lot of rich people, a lot of merchants who had the means, and they were the ones that more often went into exile. But also the prestige of the Kingdom of France was damaged. Once this news gets out of this persecution, so the Protestants today, and I had contact with a Protestant theologian in France on this, who it's one of those times where it's such a difficult time to understand, first of all, and yet it's part of the history. It's part of that continuum of what took place from the prophets and prophetesses, the War of the Camisards, and then the reestablishment, where many French historians, again, looking at, you can't prove everything that went on at that time. But many Protestant historians believe that the War of the Camisards saved Protestantism. That if it hadn't been for that war, the Protestantism might have been extinct. Of course, Catholics have a different perspective, and the first chapter of the book is what I call competing war stories, because you do have Protestant and Catholic perspectives. And as much as I try to be objective, we know there's not total objectivity. But I do include some of the writings of Catholic historians, Catholic bishops, who wrote about this time. And again, they see it differently. And part of that is because, when the king took an oath at his coronation, part of his oath was to extirpate heresy. And so, in their mind, there was no room for competing religious confession. It had to be stamped out at all costs. And so that was the times. I mean, that was their way of thinking. There's one historian who thought when Henry IV promulgated the Edict of Nantes that was wrong. And so the revocation was righting that wrong, because Protestants never should have had any rights in the first place. So, although they admit that even Abbot Ducheila, one of the main figures there that triggered the war, I mean, people recognize he was a harsh and harsh man, and the things that he did. So you do have these competing war stories, and people have to judge on their own. Because, like I said, there's legend and myth. And Antoine Cour, who came just after that I mentioned earlier, he wrote one of the major histories of this time, called The History of Trouble, of the Cevennes, where he gathered eyewitness reports from Catholics and Protestants. And it really is a magnificent work, where he tried to balance the claims of Catholics and Protestants, because some of the stories that were told, even about the assassination of Chila, weren't necessarily true in all their, aspects. They were exaggerated by both the Catholics and the Protestants. For the Protestants to justify what they had done, and by the Catholics to to talk about their martyr, that he was martyred. So, you have that going on in all the accounts. A lot of the basic accounts, I try to take different historians and some of the primary sources as much as I can, the eyewitnesses, and try to deal with that and as objectively as possible.
We're talking to Dr. Steve Davis about his new book, The War of the Camisards, 1702 to 1704. It's a little known but fascinating chapter of church history. And Steve, as always, you do a great job conveying it to us. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your coming on today.
Brad, thanks again. I appreciate it. Appreciate your ministry. I love getting your emails, books at a glance, and your interviews and book notices. And it is really a great help in ministry. So continue doing the
Great.
good work.
Great. Oh, I'm glad to hear it. Thanks so much. All right.
All right. God bless you and yours.
You too.